Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us today. Today we'll be interviewing Hakeem Awolana, a local jazz musician here in the Valley who has his own band by the name of The Ascension. Sit back and relax and enjoy the interview. You've been here in Arizona for almost 2 years.
Yes.
What brought you to Arizona and where are you from?
Well, originally, I'm from Los Angeles. That's where I was born. I moved to the Bay Area, the San Francisco Bay Area, in 79. Mm-hmm. And I lived there until about 94, and I moved to Portland, Oregon. So I'd sort of been migrating north
right. All
the time, and I was living in Portland, met my current wife there, and we hooked up. We were together for several years there, and we both were becoming less and less, enamored with Oregon. And then, ironically, her job went bankrupt.
So, did you come to Arizona with the expectation to perform? Were you performing back in California, or was that a new path that you were taking once you hit Arizona soil?
Well, that's a two-edged sword. I'd never performed anywhere near as much as I'd like to, and I don't think any jazz musician does, because the social climate today just doesn't support jazz anymore. Gigs are very few and far between. They don't pay anything, so every jazz musician I know has some other kind of job or something and just plays because they love it and because it's their passion. But none of us are working to a point that we'd like to. So I've always performed, yes, but so few and far between. And Portland was really bad.
Oh, really?
Yes. And to get more to the question, I think I was surprised at what happened when I came here. I really was apprehensive. I didn't know anything about Phoenix, except it was the desert. And I didn't know. I thought that if my career was kind of sinking in Oregon, it was really going to sink here.
In Arizona.
But I was pleasantly surprised. There's a great number of wonderful musicians here, a lot of nice people. And I've fallen into a very, very, very rich community of musicians. And I'm enjoying it. I'm playing more than I ever have, really.
Well, that's a good thing. So you have to put yourself out there.
Oh, absolutely.
Because they're not going to find you. And I think that's a lot of times a lot of people have a dream and things that they want to follow and pursue, but they don't put themselves out there. So you're always networking.
Yes, especially in this business, it's all about that. I mean, because as I said before, there's so few jobs, so many good musicians, and so few jobs, so few venues that the only way you can perform is get out and network, try to know people, try to get yourself seen and heard, and hopefully people like the way you play and you can get some doors open for you. I know specifically for me, as a trumpet player, it's just about imperative almost that you lead your own band. I mean, trumpet players just don't get that much call work.
Well, I never thought about that.
Yeah, they really don't. People who get called all the time are, of course, rhythm section people. You play the drums or the piano or the bass, I mean, you're an absolute necessity. Music can't happen without you. But in a tight economy, in a slim budget, a trumpet player is the last consideration there is. And a lot of these supper clubs and things around here do like vocal piano duos or just a little piano trio or even just a solo piano bar. So when you're a trumpet player and you're playing what I like to consider a call, traditional straight ahead jazz, you at least need four or five people, and that gets into economic considerations about who's going to hire a quintet. Where can you play with that large a group?
Now, you have a quintet, is that?
Yes.
The Ascension?
Yes.
Okay. Now, how did you form a band so quickly?
That was my goal all along. Mm. It was just a matter of meeting the people. After I got around for a while and played for a while and heard the kind of guys that I would, want to play with, then it's a matter of trying to find a gig because, the notion of a band, a lot of people don't understand, that notion sort of went out like in the 70s.
Right.
I mean, there is really no more like bands per se. These are all adult grown men who operate almost on a very mercenary kind of basis. If you have a job and you call them and they're available, they'll play. Mm-hmm. Outside of that, there isn't really any, you know, group loyalty or like, this is my group or this is who I play with. I mean, so the key is trying to find work. If you can get some good gigs and keep working and you hire the same people back again, they like playing with you, then you can do something. But without work, everybody sort of just returns to their own life and dissipates back into space. And
so you're always in search of a good gig.
Always.
I can't imagine. That's like endlessly always on in search of a job, continuous search for a job. So ideally, what venue are you looking for that you would like to make a home? The atmosphere, you know, when you're laying in bed at night dreaming of, you know.
Of the places I've visited so far, I'm sure that, you know, with at the rate that this place is growing, there are probably hundreds of venues I don't even know about. But for the ones I've seen so far, I mean, a place like Casimir's, even size-wise, a place like Johnny's Uptown.
Are you looking for something small and intimate?
Well, yes. Not too small, though. You know, I don't want the people, you know, right in front, you know, right of the trumpet bell, but not too, too small. But a place like the Rhythm Room with a nice stage and an audience, I mean...
Something where it's intimate but not crowded.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's a ton of locations here in Arizona. And it's amazing that you say, do you think that the city has just become oversaturated with the amount of performers, specifically jazz performers, in comparison to the amount of venues that are willing to have a band come in on a couple of nights a week? Or...
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. As large as this place is and as spread out as it is and with the growth rate that it's experiencing, I just think there's more of a jazz audience here than that's being tapped into. I think there's tons of room and possibilities. Just haven't really quite, you know, tapped into it yet. But I think there's a growing jazz audience here. And especially for, I think, the kind of music that I'm more interested in playing.
Which is?
Well, again, I hate labels, but I guess some people call it straight ahead jazz. Some people call it traditional jazz. But, you know, more the post-bebop era, right after, you know, with Miles Davis, Lee Morgan, Art Farmer, the whole Blue Note era of the 50s, 60s, and 70s. I think that music is kind of lost. And that's kind of more what I'm interested in. I don't really do, you know, the smooth jazz thing. And
now, when you get a gig, do you have to make some decisions? Is your full set, you called it straightforward jazz?
Or straight ahead.
Straight ahead?
Yes, that's
okay, I'm sorry. Okay, straight ahead jazz. Is that all you play? Or do you find sometimes you have to make adjustments to the audience that you're playing for when you're playing with your band?
That's kind of, I guess the answer's going to sound a little narcissistic, but... No, I don't usually make adjustments. Maybe minor adjustments, but my assumption is that the people that come to hear me are coming to hear what I present.
Style.
Now, for instance, there was a gig I did recently where there were some older couples there, and I noticed they were even dancing. It blew my mind. And so, yes, for them, I did try to gear to more like Duke Ellington kind of things and some older standards of the 30s, even the Tin Pan Alley era that they really enjoy. But that still is within my milieu of what I enjoy playing. So to that extent, yes, I will. But basically, no.
No, I respect that because so often you find that what someone is talented in and what they're good at and what they were born for, they make adjustments to get their name out there all too often. They make adjustments to just get a gig. You have to do what you have to do to pay the bills, but then at some point if you continuously do that, that's all you're known as, and you lose what it was that you know, your heart had it, you know, what you were set on, what you prefer to play. But I think there's a niche out there because, yes, Arizona has a lot of smooth jazz artists, and I have to say that. So I commend you in continuing to do what you do. I think you'll definitely find that niche out there. Now, how did you get, were you always a trumpet player?
Yes.
What other instruments do you play?
I know this is going to sound a little unconnected, but I play congas. And I love the drums. I guess that's just part of my African heritage or whatever. But I love the drums. I love Afro-Cuban folkloric music. I love salsa. And there's just something about the drums that just, if I weren't a trumpet player, I'd be a conga player.
Did you start out as a trumpet player and moved into the conga?
Yes, I started off as a trumpet player. It's the only instrument I ever really cared about. And then after I sort of grew up a little bit, I guess, yeah, right around in my 20s, I started hearing Cuban music and was fortunate enough to know a lot of really good conga players growing up, and just the music just blows me away. It just enamors me. And when I hear, you know, salsa and especially Cuban folkloric music and West African djembe music, it just does something to me. So.
Do you incorporate the drums into your performances? Do you get that opportunity?
Yes, sometimes. Not as much as I would like. I mean, if probably in the future, I mean, if I was really, really going and say we were really working somewhere and things were really happening, eventually, yes, I would. Like Dizzy Gillespie, I think, was sort of the pioneer of that. I mean, Dizzy Gillespie understood the greatness of Cuban musicians way, way back. And he was one of the first people to even begin to start what we call Latin jazz. He brought, I believe it was Chano Pozo from Cuba, mm-hmm. way back in the 50s. And so there was this sort of marriage between jazz and Afro-Cuban music, as I said, as far back as the 40s and 50s. So it's always been incorporated in the music with artists like Mongo Santa Maria, mm-hmm. Cal Jader, you know, Tito Fuente.
He was actually my first introduction. He performed, or not he, when they did the special and they got the group back together and they did a world tour and they brought him here to ASU at the Gamage Theater, and I was hooked. Tito Puente and so that was, I was hooked at that point. I was like, I'm moving to Cuba. I'm like, you know, I'm all into it.
It's something else.
And there was amazing.
Some great musicians there too. I've seen other specials, you know, DVD specials about Cuba, like Harry Belafonte narrates this one historical look at the roots of Afro-Cuban music, you know, beginning in Africa, how the slaves took it to the Spice Islands and the Sugar Islands, and it got mixed with the Spanish culture and formed and made it what it was, and then those of us that came here and it became what it was here. I mean, Harry Belafonte does this whole historical thing about that. Yeah. And there's another great DVD called Calais 54,
okay.
which is an outstanding DVD for Latin and Afro-Cuban music, so I just like it a lot.
So I will try to grab some more information out of you and get that up on the website and send people to locations where they can go and pick up the music and learn the history. Do you find that it's a dying art form? Do you have a group that you practice with, or?
No, I hear what you're saying. No, there's not. It is kind of dying. There's little small pockets of it still going on.
Here in Arizona, are you finding?
Sure. I meet Cuban people everywhere. There's, mm-hmm. There's a couple of fantastic Cuban drummers here. A good friend of mine who, the young man I told you about, Eric Green,
yeah.
who plays in my band sometimes, a very, very good conga player. And so it's in small pockets, though. I think it's like anything else. It's like a religion or anything. I mean, you can't stamp it out. It may dwindle away and there may only be small pockets of people around doing it, but I don't think it ever goes away.
Now, how do you feel, speaking of things going away, when I was in school several years ago, in grade school specifically, band was a really big part of our curriculum.
Yes.
And let's see, by the time I got out of high school in 93, band was completely stamped out. Well, and I have to say, they brought in like keyboards and electronic, you know, like Casio keyboards and things like that. But when I was in grade school, it was band practice after school, parades in the neighborhood, and we had our uniforms and clarinets. And when I found out children don't have band at all, it's an option, or you have to pay an arm and a leg to put your child in some piano lessons, or how do you feel about that? And why was that shift?
Ooh, you hit the nail on the head. I feel terrible about it. I can only speculate as to the why. I mean, all the things you hear, you know, budget cuts, and when the budget is bad, artistic things are the first things to go. I never understood that rationale. I don't know how we can live in a nation where we can pay, you know, men hundreds of millions of dollars to, you know, play with a ball and can't invest money in
our
education. That's a bafflement to me. But it's terrible, because if it weren't for public schools that I went to back in the day, and I'm way before you even,
right.
Yeah, band was an absolute joy. That's how where I learned how to play. And I got some wonderful, wonderful instruction from some wonderful, dedicated teachers. And that's one of the reasons why today there's no young people hardly playing.
At all. It's scary.
Yeah, because you couple that with also what they're pumped through the media, there's no incentive to even pick up an instrument, because first of all, everything is sampled. There are no instruments in this so-called music they listen to today. It's all electronic, it's all sampled, canned stuff, and I mean, there's no musical expertise involved. It's just some canned electronics and people talking or alluding to talking.
I think with part of our heritage, that music is extremely important. And that's one way we connect with our past. We deal with pains and struggles through that expression. So I think it's very unfortunate that that outlet is no longer available to our youth. But to keep our children on top of that and keep them in touch with the music, the heritage, and things like that, what would you recommend to a parent who is just, they're tired of the music on the radio, they're fed up with their children not having anything to do except sports, and you have to admit, not every child is athletic. What would you recommend to a parent who is looking to get their child involved in music, or if they have a child that's interested in music, that's showing some talent outside of, because right now, often it's only the church that's allowing them to have that musical outlet.
Absolutely. Tough question.
Yeah.
But,
no, that's okay. I
think one thing is, if you have a child that's interested in music, number one, you should encourage it and nurture it. You should not do like most parents and say, and make an economic, practical decision for the child. In other words, the chances of you making an economic success with this are so nil, why do you want to waste your time with it? That's most parents' attitude toward their children when they want to pursue a music or an art. Why don't you be a computer scientist, be a doctor, be a nurse, be something that's going to make you an economically powerful person? So that's our drive here in this culture, is to make money and, quote, be somebody. So they're not really trying to encourage that, or at best it's a passive hobby, because, like as I said, they don't really see an economic future at the end of the tunnel for that. And that's just a sad epitaph of our culture. But for parents who are a little more forward thinking than that, and really who just want to encourage their kids to really be the best that they can be at what they want to do, if you see your child has an interest in music, get him a teacher. Because as you said, the schools aren't happening anymore. Get him a teacher, put him in some music programs. There's a young lady, there's several youth bands and things here. I've seen some middle school and high school students here who are really good. There's a lady named Pam Marita.
Here in the Valley?
Who has a 16-year-old son who's just an absolute monster tenor player. And she plays a lot in the West Valley around the Glendale area. And she plays at places that are youth friendly, and she's somehow made an agreement with the owners or whatever, so teenagers can actually come in.
And listen.
Her son and certain middle school and high school students could come in and not just listen, but to actively participate, to sit in and play. And
you have to share that with us.
Yeah, so that's a really excellent thing that she has going. But yeah, that would be the best thing you can do, is just give them lessons, let them participate in school as fully as they can, get in youth bands and see where it goes. But the main thing is find a good teacher. That's what I would say.
Yeah. Now, what do you look for when you're searching for a good teacher? Is it their experience, their educational credentials?
I think their experience. I don't know that educational credentials really mean that much as far as a musical instrument. I mean, a person can be a wonderful player and not really have any educational credentials.
Right. I agree with you.
I think it has to do with, because those who have educational credentials and are great players that aren't teachers. So it's a two-edged thing. I think you have to not only be able to be proficient on your instrument, but you have to enjoy teaching. You have to have communication skills. You have to enjoy imparting that information. And I think that's what you look for. You just talk to them, ask them, you know, what is your playing background? What do you do? And it also, I think, depends on what the child's interests are. If your child, say, has aspirations for being in the Philharmonic, then you go seek out Philharmonic classical teachers. If he has an interest in jazz, I think you want to seek out more of a jazz-oriented teacher, depending on, I think, the interest of where the child wants to go with this music. If you want an academic career and just want to teach, of course, just go ahead to school and go through college and do it that way. If you want to play and perform, you should seek out the kind of teacher that's going to point you where you ultimately want to go.
What do you feel, or how, rather, do you feel about the state of our music now? The cursing.
You're going to get me in trouble answering this.
No, and I'm curious because a lot of people say, I mean, it's all about making money. You have to get paid. There was a time when we didn't have that opportunity to make money. So.
Okay, not to cut you off. Here's the interesting part, though. When you say we have to get paid, see, this is the interesting part. We need to ask ourselves, why are they paying so much for this particular genre of music, and who's paying it?
Yes.
Personally, and this is totally personal, totally my, as a 56-year-old man, my opinion, I think forces that are really at work more against us than for us are paying for that. If you think about it, why else would you glorify something that is A, totally pretty much non-musical, and that is so demeaning and detrimental and damning to us as a people? And I think one of the best spokesmen for this issue really that I ever heard was Steve Harvey. I saw one of his stand-up routines once. I think it was affiliated with the Kings of Comedy thing or whatever. And so Steve Harvey's whole point was that even when you were young, or say the 70s or 80s, when groups were out like the Whispers, I mean, and you know, like Steve Harvey presents it in his routine, and he talks about that music meant something. It was about love and togetherness, and it had style, it had class, it had suave. And it's gone to what it is now. It's terrible. I mean, and I think what it really is that we have allowed someone else to define for us what is cool, to define for us what is musically acceptable. When I was young, we were making those definitions. When I was young, it was cool to be intellectual. It was cool to want to strive to be articulate. It was cool to want to learn how to play chess. It was cool to listen to Miles Davis albums. That's what the older men that I saw and emulated, that's what they showed me cool was. Then all of a sudden, we listen to someone else, and all of a sudden, it's not cool to want to be smart anymore. Then, oh, you're just trying to be white.
Right.
You know, it's not cool to want to be smart anymore. It's not cool to want to be suave. It's not cool to want to be well-dressed. It's not cool to want to play chess. Now it's cool to be stupid and shoot guns at everybody. You know, so I think the definition of what is, quote, cool for young people now has changed. And I say that someone else has made that definition that did not have our best interest at heart.
Do you listen to rap, hip-hop? Any of the artists now?
I have children who are now, my baby's 26. So when I was going through their teenage thing, yes, I did. But it was a different kind of rap was kind of out then.
I was going to go there with
you. Yeah, when rap first came out, when what my kids were listening to, based on the fact that they had such a, if you will, Afrocentric upbringing, my kids were listening to this group called X-Clan. And certain rappers like that. And I even listened to the first rappers in life that these young children don't know anything about is the Last Poets. They were the first rappers,
right?
But you know, so rap can be a powerful thing. It depends on what you're saying. If you're talking about educating people about who they are, if you're talking about striving to do something, I think it could be a powerful vehicle. And it was initially, I think, until someone else got their hands in the pie, and it went from groups like X-Clan to now this total gangster rap thing,
right?
Where it's all about killing one another and pipping your women and blowing somebody away over a bag.
Or how many times you've been shot and things like that. So to be really honest about it, our children are going to listen to the music. So how would you say that we take control again of what our children are listening to, gear them in a direction back towards positive music? Because the beats are catchy. And are you saying that we need to take a more active stand in what they're listening to? introduce them to different music that they may not know that exists. Because I know sometimes my husband and I, we're all about online radio, and we'll listen to some old jazz and things like that. And I grew up on the blues. My parents were straight blues. We didn't have any jazz in the house or any R&B. It was this old school blues. So I think that we have to really be extremely active in showing that our children that there's other types of music out there. And I think the history of our music is a very important thing. I know we discussed earlier about us not being in control of our music anymore. Jazz is not our music. Blues is not our music anymore. There is no music that you can say that is ours that we've continuously held on to. And I think that's what's interesting about the Afro-Cuban and a lot of reggae and things like that. Somehow they've managed to still keep a hold of what was theirs and to keep it authentic. Yes, there's some people out there, you know, that's watered down, but for the most part, they've kept it theirs.
Absolutely.
How can we bring it back to be ours?
Woo, I don't know. If I knew that, I'd be president. Or something. No, that's a great point.
Do you think
point.
That should be a focus, though?
Woo, yes, it should have been a long time ago. Mm-hmm. I said that when I first saw rap drifting away from, like, as I said, groups like X-Clan and people like that. When it started drifting to this gangster thing, I said then, where are all the parents? Why aren't we up in arms about this now? We should have done it a long time ago. I think the damage is practically irreparable at this point. But, you know, I just really don't know, because what you're talking about is only the tip of the iceberg as far as what the whole movement of the 60s was about. Trying to redefine things for ourselves, trying to control things for ourselves and make sure that what we're doing are positive things. That didn't happen in any arena. The music is just one sad example of it. I noticed a long time ago, well, I don't know, 20 years ago, a decade ago, what you just mentioned, if you go to a reggae concert or a blues concert, you'll be lucky to see two or three African Americans there. Seas and oceans of Europeans, mm-hmm. Caucasians, at a blues or a reggae concert. So where are all the African Americans? That's their music, it's their heritage. What we call jazz, and I have a problem with that word, but that's another subject, but this music and the blues really is the only indigenous art form to the American continent. Classical music came here from Europe. I guess you can call country western an indigenous thing for, you know, for them. But I mean, blues, that's our American art form treasures. And people around the world know that. So now they've glommed onto it. Now that it's become an archived treasure, it's no longer ours.
Right.
All the blues societies are all white. All the little jazz societies like Jazz and Az here, and every so-called jazz society all over the country. Lily white upper middle class yuppies.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand that. I mean, not that they can't listen to it or it's cool, but for them to have total control of it and be now the authorities of it, I just have a real problem with that.
How can we, as a people, reclaim the music or reintroduce the music to our communities?
Well, unless we're going to, and this is the difficult part, unless we're going to get some kind of like our own radio station or get the program directors at some of the radio stations to play some different music, it can only then, I guess, happen individually. Parents have to take it upon themselves to play music for their children at home. I tried it, but in all defense of them, it's hard. You know, peer pressure is so tough, and it's like you can be, as a parent, you can be so easily isolated and become like a lone voice in the wilderness just crying as far as your impact with the rest of the mass media is concerned. And I think that's just a problem in this country. The mass media just has total control of people, our people and all other
people.
See,
but that's interesting, though, because they say, when I say the people who speak, the moguls, the ones at the top of the buildings up there, that they're giving us what we want. So do you think that the music and the media is more of a reflection of what we want, or that they're giving us something and the media and the society, we become what that is? The violence on television, the violence in
absolutely.
Music, the violence in movies.
Absolutely, what you just said, absolutely. I don't think that's what we want. I think that's what we're being programmed to accept, and I think it has a very definite purpose. I mean, this might sound, you know, far-fetched, but I read a very interesting book once by a sociology professor at, I think, UC San Luis Obispo or something like that, real left-wing kind of guy. He wrote a book called Jazz and the Revolution in Music. I don't even know if it's available anymore. I don't even know what the guy's name is. But I'll never forget that book, because in that book, he laid out what I truly in my heart believe. And that is, as I was telling you earlier, when we're making the definitions of what's cool, it's a different story. And I believe that this culture, this society, understands full well that jazz and this kind of intellectual thinking music was the spearhead of the 60s, was the spearhead of our political movement for freedom. I think they saw it as being hand in hand, and it was. And I think the sociologists saw it too, and that's what was his point in the book. You could not be a young man, like say when I was a teenager. I'm listening to Miles Davis and John Coltrane as a young man, young 20s, late teen. I'm spurred on by a different thought process, a different rhythmic beat inside me, my mind, the synopsis in my brain.
But that just demonstrates the power of music.
Absolutely it does, and they understand that. So why do you think that music was removed from us? I don't say think it was an accident. I think it was a purposeful move. That kind of music is removed because I think it was tending to create too many folk that they couldn't handle.
Well, now, okay, so but that's interesting though, because in the 80s, like you were saying, your son's a couple of years younger than I am, but we were probably listening to the same thing. And around that time, I remember sitting and listening to, you know, Public Enemy and things like that. And you were thinking, okay, there's going to be another movement going on. And then there was like this huge span, and here we are in 2006, and we've never had that type of, you know, it's all about us, black is beautiful. Do you feel like we'll ever get to that point again, or it's just become to the point where it's saturated and there's no turning back?
Wow.
Sometimes the truth hurts, but I'm interested in the know.
I would like to think that there's hope, because I'm sort of an eternal optimist. But realistically, I don't know. I think it's pretty bad. I think, as you just pointed out, around the 80s, Public Enemy, X-Clan, all that, yeah, I thought we were into they were like a new, younger version of the Last Poets.
Right.
I thought, yeah, but no, I don't know.
It's a sad state.
Yeah, it really is. Right. I don't know what else to do about it. I know that I tried to raise, you know, my own kids a certain way, and I'm real proud of the young adults they are. Obviously, you were raised in a very wonderful way, because, you know, look at you. So there are some, and I think the only thing we can do is keep kind of chipping away at it individually, because collectively, I just don't see it happening, because of the fact, again, this goes back to what I think Malcolm X tried to say, what Elijah Muhammad tried to say, I used to listen to Tony Brown's Journal all the time on PBS and stuff, what he was trying to say. If we don't ever, as a people, have some kind of economic control of our communities, if we can't ever have a radio station where we can play what we want to do, if we're always at the mercy of someone else disseminating our information and our history, then we can only expect what we get. If we're allowing somebody else to disseminate our information and write our history, I just think we're victims to that. If we don't do it ourselves, we can't squawk about how it's done by somebody else.
You mentioned a few, I know a lot of people take issue with the term black leaders, but I mean, with a lot of the passings of Miss King, and just it seems like in the last few months it's just like they're gone. You know, the idols that you remember, my sister went to church the other day and she was talking about a sermon, and it was just saying, who's coming up underneath them? Who do we have now? I think at the point where I'm 30 now, 31 now, when I'm 50, who is my son going to be looking up to? Who's going to be that picture on the, you know, the back of the church fan? You know, there were always Martin Luther King. Does that scare you? Do you have any concern with that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And on top of that, and this is a very unpopular statement, but my bigger concern even for that, it was, where are really our leaders? And why is it that they're, again, as I was just saying about the media, to me it seems like all our leaders are all appointed, though, by someone else. And not that I have anything against church. I'm a very God-fearing person. But why are we the only race of people that I know of that every time something happens, if there's a statement made on our behalf, is always by reverend somebody? You know, I mean, Dr. King was a reverend, God bless him. I mean, that's one thing. But every other nation of people all over this world, the Saudis, the Africans, the Japanese, I mean, they have political scientists and thinkers and politicians speaking for them. I mean, where are all the, like, in Reconstruction, right after slavery, when the big blast of all the black politicians, you know, were coming out of Reconstruction and trying to make a new world for us and trying to do things. Where are they? I mean, where are our real thinkers?
Our black philosophers.
Yes. Every time something happens, someone come on the news, yeah, so what do you think, Reverend so-and-so? If I want to hear what the Reverend thinks, I'll go to church. I mean, I'm not being funny either. I mean, that's, to me, reeks of this, of an old, old slavery ploy. When every time the slaves got a little unrest, they would trot out some reverend in front of them with the Bible and cool everybody down and quell them down. To me, that reeks of that same thing. In 2000, as intelligent, articulate people who should be trying to take the bull by the horns in terms of their own future, I just think we can do better for political spokesmen and politicians than, you know, it has to be a reverend all the time. I just have a problem with that.
Is there anyone there now in politics or in the media or just activists that you respect, that you respect what they're doing? Can you name one person right now?
I'm a bad person to ask about that because I'm sort of a notorious left-wing rebel, so to speak. I'm sure that everybody's well-meaning. I'm sure they all are. From, you know, Miss Rice having one of the highest, you know, positions in this country, down to politicians on this local level. I'm sure they all mean well. But as an outside observer, I have to say this is my honest-to-God true gut feeling as an outside observer. Something that Malcolm X said a long time ago, and I've watched it and weighed it carefully all my life. I think it's a little difficult to really try to make serious big-time changes in something when you're part and parcel of it, when you're reaping all the benefits of it, when you're on top of the world. What changes do you really want to see made?
Do you feel that it's either or a combination of we've just gotten to the point where we've gotten comfortable?
We're happy with
the fact that we're able to sit in front of the bus right now. We're able to walk downstairs of this establishment and sit at the counter.
Absolutely.
Or do you feel that the powers, the very strong powers at B, have made it so that way we're afraid to speak out?
No, I don't think they have anything to do with it. I don't think that really the powers to be have anything to do with it. Any issues concerning African Americans at this late date in our history in America is our own fault, our own doing.
So we've just become apathetic
I think
and
we've
lazy.
Become extremely apathetic, extremely lazy, extremely narcissistic, and the most extreme, extremely materialistic. That's all people are concerned about. A home, a couple of new cars, you know, and which, you know, those are valid concerns, I guess. I mean, everybody wants to be comfortable, but I think that's all people are concerned about, really. I don't think they really have any real concerns or cares or aspirations past that. If they've got a good job, if they're making, you know, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 a year, if they just bought that new home, if they're rolling in a Lexus, I think that's the extent of their concern. And that's...
We're not willing to sacrifice.
I don't think
so. At all.
I don't think so.
And if that's just even a meal in comparison to what our ancestors have sacrificed, a life, you know, children, things like that, to be free or to be able to speak what was on their mind at that time, we don't want to give up a good parking space, you know, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
No, you know, it is sad because I think materialism is what's going to be the detriment of who we are as a people. And that's another thing, though. I don't think that a lot of people my age, they're not involved. They don't read the news. They have no idea what's going on in politics or in their community. Hopefully, you know, a change is going to come. So at some point, I think we'll maybe possibly make that shift. I think that Arizona's an interesting place in that because we're so spread out. We really never developed a strong African-American community or minority community for that much. So I think there's some other cities that we could probably look at and mimic or mock, I guess the word is, on the things that they're doing to bring the communities back together. Some of the programs that they have for young leaders, some of the community activism. So I think that we're lucky to have you in the community. Just like the music, though, I think the music is definitely a strong thing. So I wish you much luck in getting a venue that we can come and listen to you and just experience some of the vibes that you could, you know, give us? Because music is that one thing that you always remember, and you're like, I knew exactly where I was at when that was playing, when I first heard that song, you know. Tell me, who's your favorite musician now?
Ooh, that's a hard one. Do I just get one?
No. Oh. I want to know now someone that you, that's a newcomer.
Oh.
Not some of the greats.
Oh. Hmm. You mean that play trumpet, you mean?
Any artist, preferably a young artist.
I'm not really that familiar with that many of them. I would have to say probably on trumpet, Roy Hargrove. I mean, I just know there's some fabulous young players out there, but the only one that I can really say I'm familiar with that I can say I've heard and enjoyed his playing was Roy Hargrove.
And legend? Trumpet.
I'd almost need to be able to say three or four, but...
Give us your top two.
Top two. Okay, Miles Davis and Lee Morgan.
Okay. I was like, you gotta get them on the list. Is it just style, or is it because they came in and did their own thing? Especially Miles, specifically Miles.
Well, Miles, because that's how I learned how to play.
Oh.
I started playing the trumpet in junior high school, and I come from a jazz family. I mean, uncles, father, cousins, I mean, everybody that's in the jazz. So at a very young age, I was, even though I didn't have any clue what I was listening to, I was listening to Miles Davis and John Coltrane at a very, very young age. Dexter Gordon, people like that were household, just everyday music in my house. Billy Eckstine, Billie Holiday, Nancy Wilson, Sarah Vaughan, that was everyday music in my house. So I grew up listening to Miles Davis, and so that's how I learned how to play. I would put Miles Davis albums on, and I would mimic and copy what he was doing, and that's how I learned how to play. I mean, I was well into my 20s before I started really learning anything about the aesthetics of music and scales and chords and all of that. I mean, I could read music,
right.
But, and then most of the teachers I've subsequently had, and even great players I've met, told me that that was the best way I possibly ever could have started.
Well, I'm sure.
Because listening and getting an idea of what you want to play and doing your ear training, they say was probably one of the most significant things you could do. So that's how I learned how to play, listening to those guys. And even still to this day, I have to say after I grew up, Lee Morgan sort of took the lead in terms of being the driving force in my life as far as what I hear musically and what I would like to hear myself doing musically. And I just listen to him all the time. And by listening to it all the time and absorbing the music, you get more of an idea of what it is that you want to do. So I guess Miles was sort of my father, and then I sort of graduated to Lee, I guess.
Favorite all-time jazz album? You only get one on this one.
Okay, I only get one, huh?
Only one. He's thinking hard here, y'all.
Oh, no, yeah, okay, but one, okay, All Blues.
All Blues? Why is that your favorite?
It was the first song I ever learned, and because just the personnel. I mean, if I were going to put a piece of music into a space capsule and shoot it away as in terms of a time capsule or something, yeah, because, I mean, it was Miles Davis, Cannonball Adderley, John Coltrane, that's probably the greatest trio of horn players in the world, and the music they created, I think, was just timeless. Bill Evans, Jimmy Cobb were some of the greatest musicians of this music, and so for that reason, I'd have to say that would be it. I mean, if I were to put, say, the same thing like for blues, you'd have to probably pick, like, you know, a Howlin' Wolf or a Muddy Waters, mm-hmm. or an Elmore James, mm-hmm. or something like that. You know what I mean? To be representative,
right.
of what the blues,
right.
is.
Right.
And the, you know,
the stuff my father had and listened to, and he grew up in Arkansas, and it was just, you know, it was always on cassette tape. I'm like, Dad, where'd you get the music? I can't find it anywhere. Like, I'll turn it on a blues station, and I don't know this. And I guess that's the equivalent of that smooth jazz type of thing. It was, mm-hmm. you know, that stuff that you just really be, you just... Like, what are they experiencing here? And the words, and I think about it, though, the words weren't always, you know, clean for a seven-year-old to be listening to, but it was just like their life, and you felt that, and you knew where they were
yep.
coming from. They
yep.
were speaking
yep.
from, like, the heart.
Absolutely.
They've lived it.
Absolutely. And, you know, I want to suggest a CD for you, too, because it really ties in with everything we've been talking about. It's kind of a, I guess you'd have to find it in the new world or new age genre, whatever, but it's called From Mali to Memphis. Because what really got lost, and the shame of all this, is that gospel, blues, and then the outgrowth of what we call jazz from that is all one link, all one river, all coming from one place, that the music we brought here from Africa. And that's what the CD illustrates. They'll play like Muddy Waters for you 1 minute, and then play something by some Senegalese musician, Amadou Toure, or something next, and you really hear the difference. And what we came, when we came to this country as slaves and made these five-string guitars out of pails and catgut string or whatever, we were only mimicking what we did in the Gambia and in West Africa. I mean, the people who played those, it's a koto-type instrument, they were the historians and the keepers of all the knowledge. If you ever saw Roots, when he went back there, he had to sit for 2 hours while this guru recited the clan's history. It's not like a book. You can't just turn to the last chapter of what he wanted. So he sat there for 2 hours while this man orally recited the entire history of that region. And then when, you know, the part was played by James Earl Jones, he was just about to fall asleep, and the griot got to the part about that matched his story.
Damn, right.
So I'm saying that to say that that kind of guitar playing and that kind of singing and that kind of thing is ancient. So when you hear people like Lead Belly and Muddy Waters and that Delta, Mississippi Delta blues stuff, that's nothing but our form of West African music. And of course, now with the pain and the suffering they're enduring, took another twist, but it's the same, and that's what that CD tries to illustrate.
But you know people are going to come looking for you now, see, because no, the young artists out there, the 50 Cents and things like that, that's all they're saying that they're doing, is that they're just expressing what they live and see and experience every day. So we're going to have to follow up on that one, because I'm going to get some emails and some phone calls on that one to make that connection. What, if any, I always like to know where, like, people are right now. Are you reading a good book or anything on your nightstand?
Right now, I guess I'm just so tunnel visioned practicing. But it's kind of tough reading, but I really enjoy Joseph Campbell.
Okay.
And that's what I'm trying to get through right now, but it's pretty meaty and weighty. I mean, Joseph Campbell is this mythology professor. I don't know if you're familiar with who he is, but
I will look him up, though, as soon as I get home.
Okay. There, I saw him on PBS, Bill Moyers. In fact, it's available on DVD. There's an interview.
The interview?
Mm-hmm, with Joseph Campbell by Bill Moyers, and I think it's called The Importance of Myth or something like that. But anyway, Joseph Campbell is just I think, phenomenal thinker. Unfortunately, he's dead now. But he was a mythology professor, and I think what he did was what I wish the world could do. He saw the common thread and the commonality of everything rather than the difference of everything. If you study the creation myths of all the indigenous tribes from all over the world, all over everywhere, he saw a common thread in their creation myths and in their stories, which, you know, leads one to believe that there's more commonality about what's going on than difference. I heard this very interesting thing, and I'll leave you with this, is that there's only one truth, and that truth is like water. And it can take the shape of whatever vessel it's in, but its essence is still water.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the bigger truth that Joseph Campbell and I think any real thinker of today is trying to get at, is that we're really all just one. And whatever truth has been revealed at whatever time to whatever people, it all meant something, and it was all valid. And there's no one person's philosophy or no one person's idea about that philosophy that's any better or any more valid than another.
I truly believe that. I believe that. I'll have to look that up, because that's always been a thought of mine. So who knew I was just this amazing philosopher here? Okay. Well, where can people find you? How can they contact you?
I have a website now that's been up for a couple of weeks, and hopefully pretty soon it'll be linked up with yours
music,
and et cetera. But yes, it's www.thebrassman2c.com.
And I will have that link up from the podcast, so that way people can go directly to your site. If they want to book a gig with you, if someone has any event or a venue, they need some performers, some artists, a band.
They can get me right on the website.
Okay.
I mean, all the numbers are there. In fact, when you click on the website, there's a that says contact, gig information. The email comes directly to me. I'm not sure if there's any phone numbers posted on there or not, but certainly the email comes directly right to me. So.
And CD, do you have any CDs out? Where can we go and buy your music?
Not yet, but that's what I'm working on. That's my product. My project now is to put out a nice project that I can put out for people.
And do we have a next gig to go and check you out?
Not as we speak, but hopefully soon.
Okay.
And as soon as I do, I will certainly contact you, and it'll be
Let
posted on my website, and hopefully you'll be able to post it on yours as well.
I'm extremely excited now to go and check you out.
Thank you.
So I invite everyone else to go and visit your website again, which is www.thebrassman, the number 2.
Mm-hmm. And the letter C.
The letter C.
Mm-hmm.
.com.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Courtney.
Oh, thank you.
To find out more about Hakeem, please visit our site at www.haveawonderful.com and click on our cast, and that'll take you to some additional information on books or any music that we've discussed on the site. If you have any comments or any questions that you would like to submit, you can reach us at rcast@podomatic.com, or you may call our audio comment line at 206-202-7694, or visit us at rcast.podomatic.com to record your audio comments online. Thank you so much for listening, and have a wonderful day.